Thank you, Toby. Thank you for the invitation, and I look forward to our discussion. What I will present is overall indebted to the incredible research done by my predecessor at UCL, John Doyle Clear, whose research results I will be presenting here. John passed away in 2007, and I have been honored to publish his last monograph together with Dr. Fisher and Helen Clear, on which much of what I will discuss today will be drawn. This monograph is entitled Jews, Russians, and the Pogroms of 1881-82. Devoted to this very crucial moment in history when anti-Jewish violence became a highly politicized mass phenomenon in Russia. What I want to do is to present some of the trajectories of anti-Jewish violence in Eastern Europe and also open up space for discussion. I very strongly disagree with my predecessor in his differentiation between riot and pogrom. I think these are very hapless attempts. Certainly not your research, but the attempt to distinguish between riot and pogrom is just a translatory problem of translating a Russian term into Western languages, but not making a lot of difference in the substance we are discussing. I hope to make this point with a contrast between two sets of maps, which I will be showing in the course of my talk. So, Eastern Europe, when I talk here to members of the Jewish community and I tell them that I'm working on Eastern Europe, the first answer I get, yes, pogroms. So Eastern Europe is very much identified with anti-Jewish violence and with anti-Jewish violence of a very specific kind, a mass-based, broad violence. I would like to share with you one example for a smaller, what my predecessor would probably call a riot, an attack on a celebrating Jewish community in Warsaw in the year 1871. On the evening of Sukkot, cheery and even-minded Jewish families had sat down in their beautifully decorated huts as a mob of around 50 Christians assaulted them and beat and kicked men, women, and children. The head of police in this 9th district, we are speaking about Warsaw, the capital of Poland, angrily dismissed the complaint, claiming it to be a non-issue as nobody had been killed. The very next day, unconfused attacked a Jewish funeral, but this time the perpetrators were arrested. The point which I will make in my short discussion here is that we can gain insights by trying to theorize anti-Jewish violence, and I will use a model which has been used not only by John Clear but also by experts like Paul Brass or Donald Horowitz or Senator Charles de la Roche, working on anti-African-American violence in the United States, looking at the relationship between communities in order to understand why violence happens and how it happens. And why this first citation is so interesting is that this seems to be a manageable kind of violence in the sense, sorry for my very colloquial choice of words, fact that there is, as you can see, an instance here of appeal. There's somebody to turn to, namely the policeman or the head of police of the 9th district. He dismisses the case or he accepts the case that this is something bad, or he says this is not something not so bad. And I think the case of anti-Jewish violence in Pomerania in 1881 is extremely irrelevant in this context because if we compare the simultaneous anti-Jewish violence in Pomerania, which is, of a pogrom type, with what happens in Russia, the difference is not in the violence, the difference is not in the motivations and the acts. The difference is in the reaction of the government or the administration. where when you have in Pomerania, once these riots occur, one soldier every 50 meters in these Pomeranian communities for 1 year, no further violences occur. If you look at the Russian Empire, which Don Clear has fought in a fortuitous formula defined as a malpoliced state, there were no ways to control violence which would erupt in a way which I will illustrate using a map. So very important to understand the dynamic of violence is to understand how people do things and what keeps people doing from doing things. So let me share with you a map which you obviously cannot understand in detail, but this is southern eastern Tsarist Russia. This is actually exactly where the separatists today fight against the government in Kiev. And to look at the levels of history in this particular region of Europe is highly fascinating, but I won't go into the Ukrainian dimension of things. What you have here, and which you cannot, I have to explain it because it's too far away, too small. These are, each place on the map is a place of an anti-Jewish riot. And what we did for this map is to differentiate between the first, the second, and the third decade of the first wave of violence occurring in Russia in after April 1881. So what you see is that there are dots all over the place, and it's very messy. It's not systematic. This is a map which you find in John Clear's monograph, by the way. You have in the cutout, the detail map is one example. We could just do one example of how violence would spread around a place which is called Smela. These violence, it is impossible to establish how this violence spread, why it spread, to which places it spread. This was, to a large extent, spontaneous violence, which was directed against the Jews. Just to summarize things which you probably all know, that the violence in Russia broke out after the assassination of Alexander II in March 1881. A Tsar who was very, very highly valued. He was the liberator Tsar, and the distress in the population was considerable. In one place, Elisavetgrad, which is more or less there. A first riot breaks out after a tavern brawl, totally unpredictable, and spreads from there. And in the course of 1 year, around 400 incidents of anti-Jewish violence happen across this region. 400 riots or pogroms, I really don't care how you call it. In these 400 instances of anti-Jewish violence, around 20 Jews were killed. Also, 20 rioters were killed, mostly by police or other forces of order. So if you do the simple arithmetics of this violence, you will see that the major energy of this rioting was not lethal. It was not attempted to kill. In the first place, it was not the prime objective of this violence to kill people, although people got killed. What is also very important to understand is that this violence occurred in a region which was not of long-standing Jewish settlement. Jews moved into these regions in the first decades of the 19th century. So it doesn't happen in Polish territories, it doesn't happen in Lithuanian territories where Jews would be living for 300, 400, 500 years. But these are territories which had been conquered from the Ottoman Empire in the late 18th century. This is relatively young Russian territory and a relatively young Jewish settlement. So you have a fluid situation of cohabitation of very diverse type. It is a period of massive in-migration and massive economic change. To sum up, the main characteristics of this wave of violence, which is so iconic also in Eastern European history, as well as in Jewish history, perhaps more in Jewish history than in Eastern European history, is that it is normally understood as the first modern wave of anti-Jewish violence. It is an urban phenomenon, so the villages are spared from this violence. It happens in the towns. It is a phenomenon which found successor events. So, like in the place like Smela, for example, you have an anti-Jewish pogrom or riot happening, and then in all these places around Smela, you have anti-Jewish violence erupting. The factor which made this violence modern, and I think we can actually link it to the to anti-Jewish violence in German territories, for example, the Hep-Hep-Krawalle, is that they were spread through modern means of communication, especially the press and the telegraph and the railroads. So the more modern communication gets, the faster the violence becomes. We can draw a straight line, I would say, from there, from the telegraph in Russia and the railroads to La Radio des Collines in Rwanda in 1994, where the radio proved to be the most important organizer of a mass murder. What is very important to understand in the context of understanding the dynamic of the violence is, and here I already referred to the theoretical model I would like to introduce, the competitive ethnicity model, is that the government was perceived as passive, weak, and distant. So it is not the head of the 9th District Police, it is the faraway Tsar, and in this case, in a period, the Tsar is killed, and the state is not there anywhere to be seen. So what we have is a situation of volatile social and economic situation in a relatively recent form of inter-ethnic cohabitation, where a spark might suffice to trigger the violence. Again, as I said, in the case of these iconic events of 1881, 82, not extremely violent riots. One element which I think is very important to understand the general European pattern of anti-Jewish violence is that there's a learning curve. So places which had violence in 1881 would again have violence later or early in the 20th century, and there's a very distinct difference between places which had experienced anti-Jewish violence or where people had been involved in anti-Jewish violence, where the violence which would occur in the early 20th century would actually be much more violent than in other cases. So people learn to be brutal or learn to attack other people. And there are many, many examples for this. Izetgrad, Kiev, Balta, Smela, Pierre Yaslav, and many others. So what is this competitive ethnicity model based on? So the first, it tries to identify the factors which actually facilitate the outbreak of inter-ethnic violence. And the first factor I already mentioned, it is a perceived weakness and passivity of government in general, police. another factor, at least as important, probably more important, and this is really a factor in inter-ethnic violence wherever you look. You could also look at inter-Asian violence in Birmingham to prove this fact, is that in the moment where a majority population in a place, in a given place, perceives a group, a minority or marginal group as overtaking, the risk of inter-ethnic violence rises dramatically. So a majority used to be in a superior position sees a dynamic minority group or group of marginalized group gaining in prominence, gaining in success, and raising the stakes of inter-ethnic cohabitation. This is what is an ubiquitous phenomenon of inter-ethnic violence, which was obviously the case in terrorist Russia in this period of time. An additional factor which has been commented upon a lot is obviously the ideological reinforcements of stereotypes and prejudices which somehow frame the violence, because you need somebody to tell you that you are allowed to cross the red line, you can smash the window, you can hit a person, you can rob the property. So the people who do say that are those people which Paul Bress, in his really seminal, pioneering introduction to his volumes, Riots and Pogroms, has called pogrom specialists. And I take issue with the identification of the pogrom perpetrators as lower classes. This doesn't work. The lower classes themselves are not attacking other people. That sounds arrogant when I say they need somebody to tell them. But who are crucial in this process of triggering and allowing for violence are people who explain why it is just and correct to do it. So the teachers, the journalists, the priests, the administrators, the police people, the generals, they are telling you can cross the line. And then people will cross the line. And it is not important who is on the other side of the line, a Jew, a black person, or an Asian, and who is on this side of the line, a Russian, a Pole, or a Jew, or a Palestinian, to raise a couple of waves here. So this is all based on a model which is defined as relative deprivation theory. In the moment when you have a very clear shift in relations between larger groups of population, then the risk of violence raises, and it is all about governance, it is all about policing whether violence will happen or not. I would be, just for the sake of a discussion, I would be very, very clear on that point. But obviously the definition of these groups need to be culturally plausible. So the usurer, the Jewish usurer, for example, or the visible minority, or the whatever is usable in this context, is used to define the other as being the one who can be attacked or can be defined as a legitimate target of violence. What needs to be said for the violence in Russia in 1881-82 is that it was actually only to a very, very limited amount motivated and explained through religious concepts. In many cases, synagogues were not attacked in places where riots happened, and the slogans which were shouted was "Down with the Jews" or "Out with the Jews." But not out with the Christ murderers. Although we have in Eastern Europe a rich and deep current of blood libel accusation traditions, which would offer a lot of references here. This was not the case. Also, what was not the case in 1881, 82, relatively few looting took place. So it was not in the sense of earning a lot of assets by robbing. I don't know what I have here. Okay, that's a bit later. We come back there. So what is extremely important is to understand the role of governance, of policing, and the understanding of the relationship between communities in a given commonwealth. So learning curve, that I covered that. So what is the case is that the riots in 1881, 82 were the beginning of a development which would lead to a more dramatic violence, most notably in Chisinau in 1903. In 1903 in Chisinau, Edward Judge has written about this, in one day or 2 days of rioting, as many in one place, one incident, as many people, no, more people got killed than in the 400 riots in 1881-82. So this is why Kishinev is such an iconic event, because this is really something which goes in the direction of mass murder violence with a very strong impetus to actually destroy the other. The model of competitive ethnicity has this advantage to it, that it helps us understand that in these communities, Russia, Poland, Lithuania, Hungary, Romania, where you have very sizable Jewish populations, violence has occurred, but the communities overall lived side by side in a rather unproblematic way. So these violence are like crystals of eruptions between communities. And here it is. This is a quite important dimension, because the pogrom, to define the pogrom as a type of event which strives to the annihilation, to the expulsion or the annihilation of a different community, is not correct if we really want to understand what the pogrom in Eastern Europe was. The pogrom, as I said, the pogroms in Russia in the 19th century are riots, as in Pomerania, or as the riots in other places, in other times as well. I would very much insist on that. I don't know, how much time do I have?
A couple of minutes, if we could conclude.
Yes. To illustrate the way the central authorities understood the violence and why there is a disconnect between the central power in Tsarist Russia and these developments, I have a citation of Nicholas II, certainly not a Tsar liberator. To the contrary, he certainly didn't like the Jews. A whole mass of loyal poor people suddenly made their power felt, and he talks about mass violence against the Jews in the context of the revolution of 1905, 1906. Thousands of people got killed. I mean, this was really massive violence. A whole mass of loyal people suddenly made their power felt. And because 9/10 of the troublemakers, revolutionaries, are Jews, the people's whole anger turned against them. That's how the pogroms happened. This is how a Tsar understands politics. Certainly, but in a certain way, a very good illustration of the point I wanted to make. Now, that's leading us astray. Now, my point for discussion for our debate later. I have a real issue with the use of the term pogrom. Pogrom just means riot. It's Russian for riot. Full stop. There's no different quality to the term. Why and how has this term been appropriated in Western historiography? This is something which I find very interesting, and we heard an example in the introduction to this event, the November pogrom. Okay, so let's assume what happened in 1938 was a pogrom. Let's look at the map. You remember the map from Russia, right? Messy dots all over the place over a period of 1 year. These are the German Jewish communities in the year 1932. Just have a look at the map. You have the corridor, which has been taken from Germany by the Nazi allies. Each green dot is a Jewish community. Now have a look at what happens in one night. This is one night. This is not a pogrom. This is terror. This is state terror. This can only happen by somebody picking up the phone in Berlin or in Munich and telling people what to do. And telling them what to do in one night, whom to target, what to do, burn down the synagogues, arrest the people, arrest the leaders, bring them to the concentration camp, all in one night. This has nothing to do with a pogrom, which doesn't mean that a pogrom is fun or not bad. A pogrom is very bad. But this is so much worse, because this is exactly what leads to Treblinka. Yeah. And this is what I would like to propose for our discussion. Thank you. Yeah.